Tell me when. I assume it's now. Okay. So we did the laws of kosher last time, and I would like to continue in terms of the expression of these laws and their extension for the B'nai Noach. Now, insofar as kosher itself, as you know, a B'nai Noach can keep kosher, and we explain the four benefits of kosher on the four headings that it came under. And one was idolatry, one was removed from the primitive, and then you had the benefit for the keeping the Jewish people. they were keeping their own identity, so they shouldn't eat together with the Gentiles and lose their monotheistic and Torah beliefs. And then there was the concept of raising the person to the higher sphere, the usual purpose of Torah, which is to get man to be involved in the higher sphere and to exercise the supremacy of his soul, his intellect, his mind over his instinctual nature. And a B'nai Noach can do that for those benefits, except one wouldn't apply to the B'nai Noach, but the other three would. Now, there is another question, and Robin Flynn raised this question. The question is, what about a B'nai Noach being a vegetarian? Because we know that originally, when the Torah was given, when Adam was created, he was not permitted to eat meat, as it states in the beginning of Genesis, that I have given you all the grass of the field to eat, and the right that man has to eat meat was only enunciated in the Bible after the flood. That was a special communique given to Noah. So before that time, Adam was not permitted to eat meat. So the question arises, is there any benefit for Ben Noah, or even for Ben Israel, if he wishes to take upon himself the abstention from meat and being strictly a vegetarian? Is there any benefit in doing that? Is that something which is preferable, since God originally told Adam that he's allowed to eat all the vegetables and all the fruits, but meat he was not permitted to eat? That's the question that was raised. Now, I'd like to first of all clarify what the law was exactly for Adam. There is a question here. The question is that when you look at the Talmud, the Tractate of Sanhedrin, we find that there is an opinion there that Adam received actually all seven laws, which would mean one of them would be not to eat the limb of a that is removed from an animal during its lifetime. And that's one of the seven, as you know. Now, the question is that how could Adam possibly receive that law as one of the seven if he wasn't permitted to eat any meat at all? So certainly he would not be able to eat the limb of an animal that was removed during its lifetime if he can't eat meat, period. Now, Maimonides, because of this, it seems, states that Adam only received six laws to begin with, not seven. And he minuses the law of eating the limb of an animal that was removed during its lifetime. He says that only came in after Noah. And that would seem to make sense because of what we've explained. Even though Maimonides doesn't say that's the reason for his classification, but he does have that classification, that originally there were six, and then the one that was added was not to eat the limb of a living animal. That was added at the time of Noah, when Noah became permissible for Noah to eat meat. So that's logical. Of course, the question that is raised upon Maimonides is, according to Maimonides, it should have been seven also, because what about the prohibition against eating meat? So why does Maimonides say that Adam received six commandments? It should have been seven. What about the commandment of not eating meat? So the answer that is given, as far as that question is concerned, is that Maimonides is only listing commandments. See, when you list commandments, for instance, in the 613 commandments of the Torah. Now, there's a whole science about how exactly to list commandments, because if you look at the Torah, you look at the Bible, it's hard to know what is an individual commandment and what is not, and you can come up with many more than 613 or less. So that's why Maimonides, who wrote a special work on the 613 commandments, he had an introduction with 14 chapters on rules of how you determine what is a commandment and what is not. It's a whole science. But in that system, Maimonides mentions that we never count any commandment that was not given permanently. Of course, there were certain things in the Torah that God commanded Moses, and those commandments did not were only for the time being. They didn't exist afterwards. For instance, blowing the trumpets when the community moved, and exactly how they had to live at that time, which is in Numbers. So that was only during that time that they had that commandment, but that was not a permanent commandment for generations and generations. So Maimonides makes it clear that we do not count a commandment when we're trying to list the 613. Any commandment which is not permanent, doesn't make the list, because it's not a commandment that is for generations and generations. And the 613 that were given at Sinai, when we say 613, we mean 613 permanent commandments for eternal, as the Torah says, it is a commandment, an everlasting commandment to your generations. The everlasting commandments are the ones that we count. So the answer here is given as to why didn't Maimonides say that Adam received seven, and one of the seven being not to eat meat. So the answer is given that Maimonides himself says he did never classify commandments. When you enumerate commandments, you don't enumerate commandments that were only given for a specific amount of time but weren't permanent. And since the commandment not to eat meat was not a permanent one, it was only given till the time of Noah, so that's why Maimonides does not list it. That's one of the answers that is given. I'm just mentioning this to you, as parenthetically as we go through this. But let's get back to the main question. The question was, there still is a scholar in the Talmud, a reputable scholar, who states that Adam received really all seven commandments. And he states one of them is not to eat the limb of a living that was removed from a living animal. And the question, of course, is how could he make such a statement if Adam was not permitted to eat any meat, period? Now, the answer, the Tosafists raised this question right on that, right in the tractate of Sanhedrin, right on the spot. And the Tosafists give a very straightforward, logical answer. And they state, I'm going to just use my own formulation. What the Tosafists say is that even though Adam was not permitted to, under certain circumstances, to eat meat, it does not mean that he was a vegetarian. Now, how is that possible? Can anyone, perhaps somebody wants to volunteer an answer? How is it possible to say that Adam,
okay. We got two, and the first one we'll strike. He said that he eat fish, and fish is not considered meat.
No, but there's no law of
all right. So the second logical thing would be that if the animals died, then he would eat the animals that died naturally.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. That's what the Tosafists say. Tosafists say that Adam really, there was no prohibition for him to eat meat. And this is important. There's no prohibition to eat meat. He did not have to be a vegetarian. The only thing was he couldn't take life. That was the commandment. So if an animal died, then he would be he'd be allowed to eat it. Or if he came upon a kill, he'd be allowed to eat the kill. However, if a limb was removed from that animal during its lifetime, then he would not be permitted to eat that. So therefore, there is no problem, the Tosfos say. Even though Adam was not permitted to eat meat, he still had the violation, the mitzvah, the commandment, of not eating the limb of a living animal. Of course, actually, he wasn't, strictly speaking, not permitted to eat meat. He was not permitted to kill in order to eat meat. But he was allowed to eat meat. He was not obligated to be a vegetarian. Now, this fits in, really, when you look at the verse in Genesis. It doesn't speak about a prohibition of eating meat. The verse lends itself to this interpretation, because the verse states, if you look at it, it's Genesis 1:29, and God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree on which is the fruit yielding seed, so it shall be for food." Now, the what it means is, over here, if you take a look before, 28, for instance, "And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And then God says, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree," which means to say that God did not give him, even though God gave him dominion, but he restricted his dominion. See, 28 is the general statement, where God gave man dominion. But then in 29, he restricts it. And he says, "But insofar as food is concerned, your dominion is limited to the vegetative. You can't exercise your dominion over the animal kingdom and use them for food." That is the plain interpretation of Exodus 28 and 29. But it doesn't say anywhere that he is not permitted to eat any meat. But what the concept is, as you read 28 and 29, is that his dominion, he has dominion over the animal kingdom. In other words, he could do he has a certain control over nature that the animal kingdom doesn't have. He controls them. He can move them out. He creates cities. He has the ability to move them around, to use them in a certain sense. But he cannot kill them for food. Okay, so therefore there is no problem with the scholar of the Talmud that maintains that Adam really received all seven laws. Okay, now what happens next? What happens next is that man sins, and then God brings the flood. And the flood is the Noah and his family is saved from the flood, and the rest of the civilized world perishes. Now, after that, God says to Noah that you can't eat meat, okay? And the statement is in 9:3, okay? "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. Okay, but flesh with its life, which is its blood, you shall not eat." Okay, the question we have to raise is, why did God change the commandment? Okay, we know God doesn't change his mind.
Rabbi?
Yes.
A question has been asked that, did Adam make sacrifices of animals?
Yes.
All right.
"That I make recourse to the oral law. As a matter of fact, the Maimonides states that Adam sacrificed and Noah sacrificed in the same place where the temple mount is."
Okay. In that vein, was Adam permitted to eat the sacrifice, or was it only burnt offerings?
Only burnt offerings.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay. now the so now the question is what happened? Why did God suddenly allow man to eat flesh, eat meat, to kill, actually? Okay. This, in order to understand this, what we have to do is understand the basic philosophy of Torah, a basic principle of Torah. And we've come across it, but I think we should really focus on it a little more. You see, the concept, the philosophy of Torah is two things, the philosophy of Torah, and then also what is the nature, why was Adam really prohibited from eating meat? Those two points we have to understand. If we understand those two points, then I think we'll have the solution to this problem. Let's take the second point first. Actually, I think it would be better if we go that way. The second point was why was Adam prohibited to eat to kill animals in order to eat them? Okay. Any suggestions? Now,
could you repeat the question, please?
Okay. The question is, can anyone explain why God prohibited Adam from eating, from killing animals in order to eat them?
Okay, we got one. Because the animals were in submission to Adam.
And God wouldn't allow him to kill them because it would be so easy.
And God would not allow him to kill them for food because it would have been so easy.
It would have been easy?
Yes. Because he had dominion over them. He could just walk right up to them and kill them.
Well, we seem to be doing that right now.
Well, no, we shoot them from a long way.
Well, we raise them and we kill them.
All right, the second one is that God's giving them time to replenish the earth, the animals.
He's giving who time?
The animals time to multiply and fill the earth.
I would assume there were plenty of animals around.
All right, we're assuming there are plenty of animals around.
Oh, I see. You mean to say at first, in order that there should be a certain amount of animals. I see what you're saying. All right, okay. What I like to do is, I like to always get the philosophy, try to get the philosophy from the Torah itself. Let's look at the verses and see if Genesis maybe has a clue here in the for what the reason is. You see, take a look at 28 again. 28 and 29 go together. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Replenish the earth and subdue it. This means that man is given the ability, unlike any other animal, man is given the ability to subdue the earth. That is really progress, technological progress. And then he says, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Okay? And then God, in 29, he restricts it. Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed and every tree which yields fruit. To you it shall be for food. So, really, what is going on in these two verses? What is these statements? God is giving man dominion over the fish and over the animals. And then he says, but I'm restricting your dominion. Why do you think God would restrict man's dominion? The answer, I believe, is an intrinsic one. It's derivable directly from these verses. What it means to when man receives dominion, when God gives man dominion, what it means is that man has certain rights in the system. Who sets up the system? God sets up the system. And that's why we one time spoke before, we said there can't be any concept of justice if you do not believe in God. Because justice means that there's someone who set up the system and you have no right to break the system. But if there's nobody behind the system, there's just no law. So I can kill anybody, do anything I want. I didn't do anything really bad because in whose eyes did I do something bad? Maybe in the person's eyes who I killed, but I don't have to worry about him. He's not around there anymore anyway. So the only time you have a system of justice is if you have some being behind the system that sets it up, and now you're violating, you're doing something wrong because God has given you certain rights but not other rights, and you've broken your assigned position in the universe. Okay? Now, in verse 28, God is assigning man a position. And in verse 29, he's limiting it. What is God saying, basically? Basically, God is saying to man as follows. You have certain rights that I give you, but when I restrict your rights, you must also comply. Why? Because man must always know one thing, that everything in the universe really is God's. And that's what we say in Psalms, that the earth and everything that exists in it belongs to the Creator, to the Almighty. Man must be aware of this philosophy. This is important, because if man becomes egocentric and just thinks that everything is his, then he has no relationship with God, he has no relationship with the source of all reality and all existence, and he becomes even worse than the animal, because the animal naturally is able, because of his instincts, to stay within the framework that God created for it. But man is a being that is, in a sense, limitless. He can go wild, and he can forget the Creator and forget the nature of his existence, and therefore defy God and destroy the order which God created in the universe. So God said to man, "I'm giving you dominion, but I'm restricting you." Why? Why was the restriction? The restriction was always to remind man that this is not his world. This is God's world, and that he has to live in accordance with the way God designed it. He has certain rights, but these rights were given to him by the Creator, and they're not his own. And at the outset of creation, God said to man, "You have no right to change, to make any change in so far as the species are concerned. The species is something which I have created and I designed, and this is my design. You cannot infringe on that design in nature. You can't make that change." Now, I want you to understand this. This is an important principle in Torah, and that is that whenever we say, like, for instance, you're familiar with the law that if you happen upon, the law in Deuteronomy, that if you happen upon a nest with a bird and the eggs, the mother is resting on the eggs, so you're not permitted to take both. You must send away the mother and take the eggs. The Talmud states that anyone that says that the reason for that law is because God has pity on the eggs and on the mother, is on the birds, in other words, that is erroneous. That's not true. Why is that erroneous? Because the Talmud maintains that God doesn't have pity on the bird. The reason why God gave the law is not for the bird. It's not for the bird's benefit. It's for man's benefit. That man should learn compassion. That man should learn he has limits. That he can't just, as a matter of fact, one of the scholars says the reason is that man should realize that he's not allowed to make a species extinct. And we see that concept from the ark, because in the ark you see every species that existed in that area was taken into the ark. And the reason is because God didn't want any of the species to be lost. So you see, it's God's will that all the species should always survive. That's why the Torah gave the law. You shouldn't take the mother and the eggs. The reason is that a person should realize that you don't destroy a whole species. You're not permitted to do that, because that's a change in God's world. And you're not permitted to do that. You have certain rights, but you have limitations. Now, when God gave man the mandate, the ruling, that he's not permitted to eat meat, what God said to him basically was, you cannot change my creation just as you see fit. Now, it wasn't because God was concerned about the species. It was because of man's perfection. Now, man must realize that there are plenty of animals around, but man must realize that he is unique, but he can only live properly when he realizes his perfection, which is he understands his place in the universe, what he was designed to be. And he has to recognize that the universe belongs to God, and God allows him and gives him certain dominion. So these two verses go together very well. Verse 28 is where God gives man dominion, but in verse 29, he wants him to remember where this dominion comes from. This dominion comes from God. And how does man remember that? By restricting himself, by not being able to kill an animal. He can't interfere with the order of the species. That order was created by God, and he must recognize, by abstention from killing, he is actively recognizing every day that this is really God's world, this is God's order. I have certain rights, but I can't just come in here and make changes at will without God's permission. That's why man at first had the prohibition against killing an animal in order to eat. Okay. Now, the question is, that's a very nice concept, why did God change it when it came to Noah? Okay. Now here we have to go into a concept that is an important part of Torah, and that is that God relates to man in two ways. See, first, God relates to man when he sets up the system, he sets it up in a perfect way. Then, if man is weak, then God makes a change. I'll give you an example. By Balaam. You know the case of Balaam. Balaam was hired to curse the Israelites. And first, if you take a look, God says to Balaam, he says, no, he says, you shouldn't go with them. You shouldn't go with those people that are hiring you. You should not curse the people. And then Balaam persists and keeps on asking God, and finally God says, okay, he says, you can go. But you can only say those things which I tell you, you see. Now, the question here again is, how could God change his mind? All right? So, the answer is as follows. The truth of the matter is that God originally tries to have man work in the perfect system. The truth of the matter is God didn't want Balaam to go. It wouldn't be any good for him. It doesn't do him any good. There's no reason for him to go. But when Balaam persisted, Balaam was saying to God, look, I can't refuse these people. This is my livelihood. This is what I do. I can't refuse them. I have to go. So God says, okay, if that's the case, you want to satisfy that emotion, I don't think you should go at all. But if you feel you can't refuse, you're not capable, then you can give in to that emotion, but you cannot say what you wish when you get there. You're restricted. So first, God really gives man the perfect way. Perfect way for Balaam would have been to be big enough and say, look, there's no reason for me to go. God's command was not to go. I am a better man if I don't go. But he couldn't do that. He was weak. So he kept asking God and pleading. So God says, okay, you want to give into the emotion. You can't be on the same level that I wanted you to be. But this much you can never do. And that is, you must restrain, you must control your speech, and you must not say anything other than that which I tell you. Okay. So God many times allows for man's weakness and changes, make certain changes which allow for man's weakness. You see that is especially true with regard to Adam and Eve, that at first man was living in the garden, and he had a different kind of a life. But then once he sinned, God made certain changes in order to allow him to continue. Because the truth of the matter is, once a person sins, he should really cease to exist, because he doesn't exist. When God creates the world, each thing has a specific description. If you get out of that description, then there's no reason for you to exist. But God has what we call the attribute of kindness, it's called. And that means, the attribute of kindness, let me make this clear, it doesn't mean that there's an emotion of kindness in God. God has no emotion. But we call it the attribute of kindness because God acts in a way in which he makes adjustments so that man might not be able to live on the highest level, but he can live on a lower level. For instance, you find this in the prophets with when Samuel criticized the children of Israel for asking for a king. But then he said, okay, you can have the king. That's another example. Really, they should have been on the level where they didn't need the king. The prophet. So the same thing with the prophet Samuel. First, the prophet Samuel criticizes the people of Israel because they want a king. But then he says, no, you can have the king, and the only thing is you have to be cautious, you have to follow the ways of the Torah, and as you're familiar with in the in Samuel. So the what is the point over there? The point is that originally the people of Israel should have been on the level where the prophet was enough. They shouldn't have asked for a king. But their people, the people were weak. They wanted a king. They wanted to have pride. They wanted a government. And therefore, they didn't want to rely totally on the prophet because they wanted a king. So the prophet said, okay, God said it's okay. But there are certain things that you must make sure that you don't, that you don't transgress. Okay. Now over here as well, what happened was like this, that originally Adam was supposed to be on a level where, just like originally Adam before the sin was supposed to be on a level where he wouldn't sin. But then he broke down, and once he broke down, then he received a different set of situations. Now over here, the same thing is true. Originally, man was supposed to be big enough to be able to exercise control over himself and not kill the animals. So he had a constant reminder that the universe, the earth, everything that he sees belongs to God, and his dominion is a right given to him by the Creator. It's not his own. That was supposed to be the concept that he faced every day. But what happened was that man deteriorated. And when man deteriorated at the time of the flood, he was unable to do this. So the Torah, what the Torah did was, well, the Torah's philosophy is, see, the Torah is not an ascetic philosophy. I want you to understand that. The Torah does not believe in asceticism. What the Torah believes is, again, not self-control, but the domination of the wisdom part over the instinctual part. Now, you have, for instance, there is a chapter in the Torah that deals with the Nazarite, a person becoming a Nazir, which means that a person, an individual, can accept upon himself certain obligations, which you can't drink wine. And you can't, he can't, excuse me one second. I'm sorry, I can't do anything, I can't talk now. I'm sorry. Oh, okay, go ahead. So, the person accepts upon himself certain additional commandments. Now, the Nazir, if you take a look at the end of the chapter, the Nazir, must bring a sin offering. And the question is raised, why must the Nazir bring a sin offering? And the reason is, the Talmud gives a reason, because he sinned. How did he sin? The answer is because he wasn't able to drink wine for a period of 30 days. He had to abstain from wine. Now, the Torah's philosophy is that a person should be able to enjoy life. As a matter of fact, the Jerusalem Talmud states that if a person can't enjoy life, he's sick. There's something wrong with him. God wants man to enjoy life. But he must be constantly checking out his enjoyments with his intellect. Now, if a person is unhappy, a person is frustrated, so then they can't function properly. The purpose of the Torah is that a person should be in a happy state of mind, not wild excitation, but in a happy state of mind where he is conducive to thought, to Torah, to learning, to gaining knowledge. If a person is in a state of frustration, then it is difficult to learn. It makes it very difficult to learn. If a person is in a state of elation and involves himself in passion, then again, the mind can't function. So what the Torah looks for is a comfortable state where he can engage in thought and pursuing knowledge. That requires a certain emotional even keel, so to speak. Not too drastic in the highs in terms of the passionate, and on the other hand, not in a state of frustration where the person is experiencing pain. In either of those mental states, a person cannot serve God properly, cannot serve God well. A person must be satisfied in order to serve God well. So the Torah aims for that state. Now, Adam at first was on a level. You understand very well that the more a person sublimates his energy, the more a person uses his energy for in the higher realm, the less needs he has. Now, For instance, a great scholar doesn't have the needs of an average person, whereas a person of average ability has more needs. There are different levels of people. Every person has to satisfy his needs in order they should be in a state where he can enjoy life and partake of God's wisdom and knowledge. The greater the person, as I said, the less he has to satisfy his needs. Adam, at first, it was expected of him that he'd be on the level where he does not partake of eating meat, and that he'd be satisfied that way, even though I want you to realize that not being able to eat meat is a difficult thing for man, especially for man originally, before when he first started, and he hadn't really subdued the earth yet with technology. Because meat is something which, as a matter of fact, anthropologists show that if people don't have meat, primitive people don't have meat, it is extremely difficult for them. Because meat, first of all, is a very compact source of energy. And you need about five times the amount of vegetables to get the caloric energy that you do out of meat. The meat is high in calories. It's compact, and it's easily available when there's game, whereas the vegetation is much more difficult to obtain. People have to move from place to place, and it's very difficult. It's a great inconvenience for man, and especially when he's not in a society like we have today. After all these years, in the beginning, it was very difficult for man to abstain from meat. So originally, Adam was expected to be on the level where he wouldn't suffer because of the inconvenience, because he was into higher things. His energy was directed towards higher things. But man, when man deteriorated before the flood and was unable to live up to the expected level, so then there was a problem. The problem was, if he doesn't have meat, he's going to be unhappy, he's going to be frustrated, he's going to be bothered, he will not be able to serve God properly. But on the other hand, again, you have the problem, if you allow him to eat meat, if God allows him to eat meat, then he's going to be missing that whole concept of the realization of God being the one that sets the natural order, and that he has to abide by that order. So what God did was the following. God allowed man to eat the meat. But what he did was, he made the rainbow covenant. Now, when the rainbow covenant between God and man said something to man, it said to man that when you see the rainbow, that you recognize this covenant between God and between man, and that God is in his mercy, is allowing you to, is giving you a permit to kill the animal in order to kill animals in order to be able to eat. So now, what God did was, he kept the concept. The concept is still there, but he changed the way the concept would be fulfilled. Whereas originally, the concept was fulfilled through Adam actually abstaining from killing animals. Now it was fulfilled through the recognition of the fact that God gave me the permit. He is allowing me to eat the meat. So I have the same benefit because I have that realization through this recognition. And yet I don't have the harm of the abstention, which would be harmful for me because I'm not on that level where I could suffer that kind of a frustration without being upset and without an infringing upon my state of mind where I'm comfortable and I'm able to pursue knowledge. So therefore, when God introduced the rainbow covenant, he introduced a new method of accomplishing the same exact ideal, but without the harmful frustration which man, after the flood, was unable to endure. And that's why God gave him that permit to eat the meat. But there's an interesting thing, and that is that there is a law which is not one of the seven. Nevertheless, it's a law that's binding on the Ben Noach, as well as the Ben Israel, that has the same concept. and that is that the Ben Noach is not permitted to take animals and to breed different species, interbreed different species. You may be familiar with that. Now, the reason for that is because that again shows man that he must recognize the fact that God created these species, and he has no right to introduce a change and to take species and to breed one species with another, which would not normally breed together. So, for instance, to produce a mule is a violation of the Torah. You're allowed to ride on the mule once the mule exists, but you're not permitted to breed a donkey and a horse in order to have a to produce a mule. So this again is the concept, and this law remains even today, says Ben Noach. But this law is the idea of the law is to teach man that he does not have total dominion over God's creatures. Whatever dominion he has is because God gave him the right, and not because of his own rights. So that concept still remains even today with the Ben Noach. Now let's get to the main question. The question is there any advantage in a Ben Noach being a vegetarian? Okay. Well, if you mean by vegetarian he never eats meat, we explained before, even Adam was permitted to eat meat. The only thing is he would not be permitted to kill the animal. But, to my mind, I believe that there is no benefit whatsoever. I'll tell you why. Because since God created the Rainbow Covenant, and in the Rainbow Covenant, he gave man the ability to fulfill the same objective, but in another way. So, to be a vegetarian would really be to deny the Rainbow Covenant. And there is no benefit. If God gives man the permit, and God says that now man can obtain the same objective through a new system, through the Rainbow Covenant, then there's no reason for man to hark back to the old system. There is absolutely no benefit. As a matter of fact, it's somewhat of a denial of the Rainbow Covenant. It's as if man is saying, well, I'm going back to the way things were before. But God has changed that. So there is no reason to go back to the original situation. Also, if it's something which would cause a person to be frustrated or cause him to miss certain things and be inconvenient for him, so again he would be doing something which is harmful for him. And especially, I won't go into the health issue, but if it, I understand that there are certain nutrients which are obtainable only from animal products, very difficult to obtain from the if you want as a vegetarian. But that's a separate area. I'm not interested in the health aspect. But there is nothing. I want you to understand one thing. There is nothing wrong. The reason why Adam was commanded not to kill the animals was not for the animal's sake. This is something that I want you to understand. It was for man's sake, for man's perfection. So if a person says that he will not kill an animal because of the animal's sake, that is really going against the Torah system. The Torah does not teach us such an idea. That's like the person who says that God has pity on the birds. God doesn't want man to destroy the species. Man has to respect the order, but man is not allowed to cause pain in animals. That's improper. Because God's mercy is on all his creatures, but man does not have to do things that God does not instruct him to do. Since he has the right to eat the animal, and God gave him the right to eat the animal, it is absurd for man to try to introduce things that go beyond God's concept of justice and righteousness. And again, the God's primary concern is not for the animal. It is for man, for the benefit of mankind. So since in this case, the benefit of man is obtained again through another objective, through the objective of the Rainbow Covenant, there will be no purpose in man being a vegetarian today. Okay, are there any questions?
Yeah, somebody said they had one. Sandra? Gail.
Yeah.
What? No. Why should I have one? They think I might have a question. See, the reason they're asking that, some of them saying, well, I have a question because I am not a vegetarian. See, I refer to that all the time when people say, are you a vegetarian? I say no. Because I do not like the title that goes with that. The thing, I choose not to eat meat, and it's partly physical and it's partly spiritual. But I have never told anyone else here, nor have I indicated that anybody should do what I do, have I?
Well, let Maimonides state, you know, that certain scholars of the Talmud did certain things for themselves that other people would be making a mistake if they tried to copy or imitate them, because some people, some scholars of the Talmud recognize that certain things were appropriate for them. That for them, they did certain restrictions or whatever it might be. They recognized that for their personality, this was an important thing for them. It improved them, and it was something additional in their life and in their spiritual existence. But it's a particular thing, and Maimonides makes it quite clear that to try to imitate somebody like that is a mistake, even though he may be the greatest scholar. He equates that to a person who sees someone who is taking medication, and he goes ahead and takes the same medication. But the medication is only good for the sick person. It can harm the healthy person. So the same thing is true over here, that there is a realm in which an individual may do a certain practice for his own perfection, which fits his personality, and another individual would be foolish to just simply copy that. The only thing that we do universally are the universal laws that God gives every man. But beyond that, there is a realm where a person can engage in a certain perfection, and maybe certain restrictions, which for this person, these restrictions improve his personality, improve his character. If he assesses himself, he's permitted and he's advised to do that. But it's based upon a knowledge of the individual. But that's an individual thing. It's not something which we suggest that others copy us, imitate us, and do the same thing. I think that's what David is saying, and that is a principle, a Talmudic principle. Are there any other questions?
Okay, we'll jump back in here. Lawrence, you got one? John? Not on that one. Okay, I think you pretty well got it. Nobody is standing on their heads or jumping down my throat or anything else, so I reckon we're doing okay.
Okay.
Alright, and we can stop it. Gail, alright, Ray?
Rabbi say 2 weeks ago about eating pork.
They want you. What did you say 2 weeks ago about eating pork for the non-Jew, for the Ben Noach, and you said that it was okay?
Yes. Pork for the Ben Noach, yes.
Yeah, pork for the Ben Noach. He can eat anything that he wants to.
Right.
Dead, he can kill it in a humane manner. If he finds one dead, he can do it.
Right.
He can eat it.
Right.
And if a Jew owns one that dies, he can't eat it, but he can sell it to a Ben Noach.
Okay, let me,
or a Gentile.
Yeah, let me expand on that point. If you take a look at the verse,
okay,
you'll see that there is a complication there. Now, take a look, for instance, in Deuteronomy, after the laws of kosher. Now, there's a very specific formula there about that has to do with the Ben Noach, and I wanted to mention that. Now, you mentioned it, you reminded me. After it gives the laws of kosher, so it states that you should give it to the, let me just find a place. Alright, now I'm talking about Deuteronomy 14, verse 21. Thou shalt give it to, verse 20 and 21. It seems about right. You shall not eat of anything that dies of itself. Thou shalt give it to the stranger who is in thy gate, that he may eat it, or thou mayest sell it to an alien. Now, the Talmud states that, according to one opinion, and according to one opinion, Rabbi Judah, and we seem to hold like that opinion, that according to Rashi, the way Rashi interprets it, it is specific. In other words, the stranger in your gates is talking about the ger toshav. Okay? Now, here, the Torah says, you'll notice, it says, you should give it to the stranger, that's the ger toshav, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to an alien, a non-ger toshav. Now, the Talmud states, according to Rabbi Judah, that that is very specific. In other words, you're not permitted to sell it to the ger toshav. You must give it to him. And the Talmud states that is because the ger toshav is considered... You see, I want you to understand the term ger, which means a... Well, if it's stranger, it's a bad translation, because it really means like, more like a proselyte, like a person who joins the group. So there are two kinds of people that join Israel. One kind is called the ger tzedek, and that means a person that becomes a total proselyte. He accepts the 613. But the other is the ger toshav. He also is a part of Israel, and he is a part of Israel insofar as the land is concerned, that he's permitted to live with Israel, live in the midst of Israel. And over here, the Torah is saying that... when it comes to the ger toshav, you're not allowed to sell it to him. You must give it away to him, because you must show kindness to the ger toshav and consideration. And as a matter of fact, Maimonides uses that very verse in his Laws of Kings, where he states that we are obligated. When he says we, he means the Ben Israel is obligated to support the ger toshav and to help him. And he says, and that's why the Torah says that you must, he quotes this very verse, that you must that you must give the animal to the ger toshav. You're not allowed to sell it to him. So you'll ask me the question, you'll say, well, you're not allowed to sell it to him, but why should I give it to the ger toshav? I could sell it to the alien, okay, and make some money on the deal. But the answer is, first of all, that it is proper to give it to the ger toshav, but secondly, you're not permitted to make any money off something which for you is useless. In other words, the Torah over here is trying to teach man perfection. And again, the way the Torah does it is not through strict legislation, but through suggestion, where the Torah says, this animal you can't use. And I want you to know, anything that dies of itself doesn't mean a dead carcass. I mean, that sounds like a horrible thing. It means if the person who is slaughtering the animal doesn't slaughter it properly, then it's the same thing. In other words, if you have a slaughterhouse and the shochet, the man that's slaughtering the animal, he does it improperly, that means it dies of itself. Of course, it's not considered slaughtered. So it's not kosher, in other words. So then what you're supposed to do is give it to the ger toshav. You're not allowed to make money off it because you can't use it anyway. So the Torah is... God is teaching the Ben Israel, if you can't use it, don't try to make any money off the ger toshav, but be generous and give it to him. Maimonides takes it to be a general concept that that the Ben Israel must show kindness to the ger toshav, just like to the Ben Israel, and if he needs support, he must support him. Not so with regard to a Gentile that does not accept the commandments, is not a ger toshav, does not accept the seven laws. The him you could sell it to, but the ger toshav you're not permitted to, and what you should do is, it's extra, you can't use it anyways, then give it away to the ger toshav. So that is a Talmudic law. It's an interesting principle. It has to do with the relationship between the Ben Noach, the ger toshav, and the Ben Israel. And that is because the ger toshav is considered a part of Israel in a certain way, even though he only keeps seven, and the Ben Israel keeps 613, but there is a unification there. And insofar as, essentially it's expressed insofar as dwelling together in the land of Israel. The ger toshav is an official institution. Unfortunately, we don't have that institution today because you need the Sanhedrin. And you need to have the Jubilee year has to be in effect. Because since the ger toshav relates to Israel through the land, all the laws of the land must be complete in order to have that status. So the Jubilee land, as you know, there were only about 17 Jubilees that we had in our history. That was only during the first temple. Second temple, we didn't have it anymore because the Jubilee only exists when all of Israel is in, lives in Israel, all the tribes. Now, when the Messiah returns, that's one of the things he's going to do, is to, through prophecy, he will say which person belongs to which tribe. And then Israel will be, all the Jews will be in the land of Israel, and the Jubilee will return, and the status of Ger Toshav will return as well. It's part of the, they'll be part of the Messianic era. So here you have this verse in Deuteronomy, which really expresses the love between the Ben Israel and the Ger Toshav, and the close relationship that they enjoy together. It's an interesting verse, and it's pretty clear if you just, you don't need to even look at Rashi. I mean, the statement is right there, pretty open. But it says you should give it to the Ger Toshav or sell it to the stranger, the one who is not part of the system of Torah in terms of the seven laws. Him you could sell it to, but not the one who has accepted the seven laws and lives together with the Ben Israel in the land of Israel. Any questions with regard to that?
I think you're in good shape, and we will say, we can say Lala Tov on that one.
Okay.
And all right, hey, everyone wants to know where the dog is tonight. It didn't bark.
You know, I don't understand it because somebody even walked into the house, and usually when somebody does that, he goes crazy.
But right.
Tonight he's been quiet. Maybe he's enjoying the Torah.
Maybe he's enjoying the Torah. Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Okay.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.